around in this great big city. Fast money and the life will never show you no pity. Oh, I work hard trying to make my bones, but times have changed and I just got to move. Can't run away, can't run away, can't run.
Good evening and welcome to We Know a Guy Radio, a production of Bear Media Consultants. This is where we talk about everything from organized crime to entertainment. Guests will include former mobsters and retired lawmen, entertainers, writers, reporters, and successful businessmen and women. You can participate in tonight's show through our chat room or by calling in at 646-478-0982. My name is Denny Griffin, retired investigator and true crime author. Our producer, Kim Colton, is manning the switchboard. And I'm happy to be joined by my co-host, former Gambino crime family associate and author, Andrew DiDonato. Andrew, welcome.
Hey, Dennis. How are you today?
Good, good. And yourself?
Very good, very good.
We're going to talk about the mob tonight. Now, first, I want to thank Sonny Charles, who seems theme song for We Know a Guy Radio, The Life. Sonny Charles, formerly of the Checkmates. And we're going to be talking, going back, several years, actually, talking about the person who many people credit for being the first of the organized crime figures in Las Vegas. We'll get into that shortly. And our guest to talk about Bugsy Siegel initially is Llewellyn Smiley, the daughter of Ellen Smiley, who was Bugsy's best friend and business partner. And Ellen was sitting next to Bugsy when the mobster was shot and killed on June 20th, 1947, in the Beverly Hills mansion of his girlfriend, Virginia Hill. Llewellyn was raised among the elite of organized crime. She spent her adolescence in the mysterious and privileged circle of her father's associates and friends in Los Angeles, where he was under the arm of Johnny Roselli. 10 years after her father took his own life, Llewellyn evolved into a gangster authority by researching his criminal history through thousands of classified FBI and Department of Justice documents, interviews and conversations with relatives, ex-mob guys, and authors. Today, she is a published writer and recognized mob historian. Llewellyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
How are you,
Llewellyn? Glad to have you with us.
How are you, Andrew? I heard your interview.
Good.
I like it very much. Very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I like what you're doing, too.
I appreciate that.
Good.
I'd like to start off a little bit. I indicated we'd start off talking a little bit about Bugsy and your dad and your dad's relationship to Bugsy Siegel. Could you tell us what you know of, you know, their relationship and their associations and so forth?
It's a very interesting story. Do you have a few days? I'll tell you, originally my dad was a Hollywood producer, and he was working for Cecil B. DeMille for 10 years. But he was a gambler, and he was an adventurer and a maverick, and ran away from home, you know, when he was very young, 13, left Canada, came here. It's possible that he met some of the mob guys in Canada, because I traced that he went to Windsor quite a few times, and that's where they were transporting the liquor over to Detroit. So it's possible he got involved early, but I couldn't really say that for fact. But when he was in Hollywood, he was working in the studios and met, you know, George Raft, everybody, hung out with all the top stars. And either George Raft or Johnny Roselli, I think, introduced them. And my dad left the business in Hollywood. He just walked away, and he joined Ben in 1937. And he stayed with him until the day he died. They were very similar in terms of their Jewish background. Their support for their family. Ben Siegel supported his family until he died, his mom and dad. And they were fighting the government. They were rebels. They didn't like the way the government welcomed them when they came over, the Italians and the Jews and the Irish. They didn't get the big waving flag that they get today. They were thrown into Hell's Kitchen in the Lower East Side and told to fend for themselves. So this is what made Ben and all the other guys. And, I mean, from what I understand, Ben was a hero in his neighborhood because he stood up to everybody. You know, he was fearless, absolutely fearless. He knew every day he could die. It really didn't matter to him. He was just a different tribe from a different tribe, and I think all these guys were. So they formed a very close friendship, and Ben's wife and the children, Millicent and Barbara, I mean, they were always together. From even what Millicent told me, they were like joined at the hip, my dad and Ben. And that's how it happened. And he couldn't take it back.
Did your dad ever talk with you much about Bugsy, as far as, you know, I mean, if you watch the movies about Bugsy Siegel and some of the documentaries and so forth, he reputedly had a very violent side. Do you think that's all accurate? Do you think Bugsy was as violent as he is portrayed in the movies and so forth?
I don't think, personally, I don't think he was as violent, because it's Hollywood, and they have to exaggerate all these flaws in people, whether they're, you know, violent or shy or boisterous, whatever the characteristic is, it's inflated 10,000 times. Yes, he did pistol whip people, and he was extremely temperamental, but the way they portray him, it just makes me sick to my stomach. It really does.
Do you think they might overdo it a tad, huh?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. What?
You think they might overdo it a little bit when they're doing his character in big screen?
I think they do. I mean, I'm not going to say he was a Boy Scout, as I was told once. No, this man was brought up in that violence. You can't just, you know, he was only, what, 40 when he died? He didn't have a chance to reform. He was a very young man. But as far as going around and, you know, being a trigger, who said that he was a trigger-happy murderer? I don't buy it. I just don't buy it. And it's not because he was my dad's best friend. What my father told me when I asked him was simply, he was my best friend, and he would take a bullet for me. You go find a friend like that.
One thing that's always intrigued me when I've seen the Bugsy movies and so forth is the Virginia Hill, his relationship with Virginia Hill. You know, I've seen different accounts on various websites and documentaries and so forth, that perhaps she knew he was going to be hit that night and went out of the country so she would, you know, wouldn't be accused.
Did
her dad ever think about Virginia, what he thought of her?
Yeah, he told me a few funny stories about her. As you know, fathers don't tell their daughters, especially in the Jewish religion, when they're involved, really anything. And when they do, it's in a very short clipped way, and there's no questions to be asked after the story is told. But he just said she was a tiger, and he was at Ben's house one night, and there was a big dinner party. This was written up in somebody's book. And Virginia and my dad was there. I think my mom was there and a bunch of people. They were entertaining. Ben wasn't there. She came out in a bathing suit with a pistol and started waving it around. And they had to call Barney Rudisky, who was a investigator slash mob friend of some sort, and he came over and had to calm her down. So she was really wild. That's all I know. But as far, you know, there are no coincidences, as my father used to always tell me, and it is sort of odd that she just happened to be in Paris. It, you know, I don't, right? That's kind of odd.
Absolutely. Now, do you think Bugsy's murder will ever be solved?
Well, I'll tell you, it should be, because it would make for some amazing reading of classified files. I've thought about, you know, I haven't really tried to solve the case. Somebody has. His name is Warren Hull. I don't know if you've heard of him.
No.
But Warren has spent 17 years trying to put this case together, because his father told him on his deathbed who shot Ben. He was connected. And he presented his theory to me in Las Vegas. Warren did. And it was incredible, just incredible. Why can they try and solve Jimmy Hoffa's murder and not Ben Siegel's? It's 65 years. I really don't understand. They will not. I called up because when I was doing my research, I realized that they still had this jacket of my dad's with the bullet that went through the sleeve. And I got nowhere. They just said, it'll never be, it is classified, it'll never be closed. You know, we're still investigating. And he said, we're still investigating. And I said to him, I go, do you have any leads? And he didn't laugh.
Yeah. But the thing is, I think with the Jimmy Hoffa case, I think what happens is that people were so mystified that this guy just disappeared, never to be seen again. And with all the technology that they got throughout the years, they were never able to really place this man anywhere. You know, all of their information. There was a few guys throughout the years who said that, you know, Hoffa was in Giant Stadium when they built it. Other people said that, you know, he was murdered and buried underneath the house somewhere. As a matter of fact, he was in the paper 2 weeks ago. Jimmy Hoffa was in the paper. They said that they had a lead on his murder. Yeah, they were going to dig up some area.
I know.
It's amazing.
I know. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And you're right. I understand that part of it, that he just disappeared. But why wouldn't they try and close the Siegel case?
You know, I don't want to say this for every, you know, department or whatever, but what happens is with organized crime figures, you know, I was in the life, my whole life, I've seen a lot of guys pass, you know, before their time. And what happens is that sometimes they just really, I won't say they don't care, but they figure it's gang on gang related. And unless it really comes out, unless the evidence really comes out before them, I mean, they'll investigate. But unless it really comes out, I don't think they're going to pursue it 20, 30 years down the line. When it gets that cold, when that cold case gets that cold, I think that, you know, and then plus it's been generations now. So, you know, it might be super cold, freezing case. You know, it's not even like you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
When the generations change, you know, like the guy who would be investigated now probably wouldn't have even been born. His parents might not even been born at the time.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So,
yeah.
That's how I see it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so many theories. I've read all the different theories and so forth. And after it happened, my dad was the one that identified Ben's body and went to meet Millicent and Barbara at the train station to break the news. And then he went underground because the Beverly Hills Police Department was getting threats on his life. And he called up his good friend, Lou Rothkopf, Lou Rhodey, they called him. Have you heard of him? Uncle Lou,
no.
Lou Rothkopf.
No, no.
Yeah, he was one of the four of Cleveland, you know, Rothkopf, Lyman, those guys. And he had to come out and stay with my dad. My dad was just in shock, complete shock, you know. So that changed his life. That night changed his life, changed my life.
Oh, without
a doubt.
I wouldn't
have been born.
Something like that. Yeah, no, without a doubt. And you know what? I mean, you know, when a situation like that happens and it's really, really close to home like that, you know, you start to realize what could have been, and you start to really take stock in what you have from that day forward. And you know when I started seeing friends of mine die, I was 18 years old and I lost my first friend 17 years old. And you start to see your own mortality. You start to realize that this is real serious stuff here you're involved in. And it's heartbreaking. Yeah, it's heartbreaking too, because you live with some survival guilt that you knew it could happen to you when it did. And you have friends of yours who it did, and so that touches you as well.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. So in answer to your question, I guess Andrew answered it. I don't think it will ever be solved. Warren's trying, he keeps trying to present his theory to the Beverly Hills Police Department, but they won't entertain it.
Does Warren's theory, and I don't want to get into any great detail on this, but if you could just tell me in kind of general terms, does his theory involve what I think most people think, that this was a hit ordered by probably Luciano and Lansky because they thought Bugsy was had been pilfering some money out of the money that the New York mob was putting into the building, the construction of the Flamingo? Now, that's one of the popular theories of the reason Bugsy was killed. Does that go along with Lord Warren?
I think he thinks more along the lines of Dragna, Jack Dragna.
Uh-huh. And he was the L.A. guy, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not funny, but the serious aspect of that is that no matter what it is, when you're involved in criminal activity, things that you've done 20 years before the fact of your demise could have been a reason. It didn't have to be something that was happening immediately. It could have been, because along the way you make many enemies in this type of life. And, that's the shame of it, because when that does happen to somebody who's in the life, there's a treasure trove of suspects who they could choose from, or people who you crossed their path at one time and, they were on the wrong end of a bad decision when it came to you, and that's what makes it so tough.
Yeah.
It isn't like you said, it isn't like an innocent person in the street where they could evaluate this guy who he worked with, where he was. This was a I won't say family man, because we're all family men at some point, but this was somebody. It's different when you have a citizen, because they don't count up the enemies as quick as a guy who's in the street committing crimes.
Yeah. I've always thought is strange is that the bullets went into his eye. And, he was famous for those baby blue eyes. And I always felt there was some jealousy involved. I don't know, Andrew. $5 million to the mob back then was nothing. To kill him for $5 million when a few months later it wasn't in the red anymore. $5 million really wasn't a lot back then to these guys.
It's politics. And that's what happens. It becomes politics. That's all it is, A lot of guys die over money. And, they die for the wrong reasons. You get somebody who's got a little influence on other people's decisions, and then they oppose their will, and next thing you know, somebody's dead. And then when it does come to roost, like you just showed, that months later it turns around and it's a big windfall of earning capacity for the mob in the United States because of this idea that he had, then what? Then, it's too late to apologize, but that's how mob activity works. It's a shame.
Yeah, it was a shame.
Regardless what somebody does or what doesn't do, basic things is, you learn throughout your life. Like when I was younger, we never thought of the things that we were doing to the point where we sat and, mold them over. We never took stock in the repercussions of it or what was going to happen from this or whose lives we were destroying by acting out violently towards other people. And, when you get a second shot and you see things a little bit differently, you start to realize that there's no conscience in organized crime activity. You know, there's no conscience. You know, there's
yeah,
not
well,
like,
you can't have it. You can't.
Yeah, no, well, no,
it's,
no, you can't allow yourself.
You're too busy
to
figuring out the angles and how to protect yourself, right? Yeah.
Exactly, without a doubt.
Well, before we move on to some other areas, I just wondered, do you ever have any interaction or communication with Bugsy's children?
I had a very heartwarming reunion with her at the Mob Experience when it opened. And she arranged for my dad, not the Mob Museum, the Mob, now it's called the Mob Attraction, but it was the Mob Experience. And I was hesitant to go into it because I didn't want to do it unless Millicent did it. And then when I found out that she was involved, and we hadn't spoken for like 20 years, and then we were put together, and she made room for my dad's exhibit in the Ben Siegel room. And so we had a great reunion, and then things at the Mob Experience got really, really complicated, and we had falling out.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. That was the most important thing to me, to be reunited with, you know, people in my tribe. And I met, you know, many of them through the Mob Experience, and of course she was the most important one to sit down and talk with her. So, no, recently we haven't. It's been probably, I don't know, close to a year now. I pulled out of them. I mean, I couldn't pull out my collection, but I'm not involved with them anymore at all. You know, it's bankrupt, and there's all kinds of lawsuits, and everybody's stealing from everybody worse than the mob. I mean, I swear, I couldn't believe... I said, the banksters got the mobsters. You know, this was Shakespearean.
Oh, God. And remember, everybody, we're not talking about the Mob Museum downtown. We're talking about what was the Mob Experience at the Tropicana. And that particular entity went belly up, and they're reopened, I guess, and reorganized and opened as the Mob Attraction. So they're two different entities,
society.
Mob Museum downtown and the attraction out on.
Hey, Dennis, what's wrong with society when you can't trust a legitimate people and a legitimate corporation and stuff like that? You know what I mean? What's this growth
yeah.
to? You know?
I mean, all of us kids were absolutely in shock because we were all quite enthused about this, about getting to know each other. I met Giancana's grandson, and I got reunited with Lansky's granddaughter, and, you know, we have a connection that I don't have with anybody else in this world, because nobody understands us. You know, so it was really a big deal for us, and then when we started seeing what's happening, we were just all, like, our mouths were agape. Like, what's going on? We thought you guys were the good guys. You know?
Yeah. Llewellyn, I'd like to talk a little bit about when did you, as a child, first realize that maybe your life was not the norm, you know, that with your dad's associates and associations and so forth, that maybe you weren't quite like the other kids?
Yeah. I would say it was the time that I was about 13, and my girlfriend's mother had told her about this book, The Greenfelt Jungle, which came out in, I guess it was 62 or something. And she said, you know, your dad is in this book. I said, oh, okay. So we went to the drugstore in Brentwood in L.A. and pulled out the book and, you know, she went to the section with my dad. And instinctively, it was so strange. I didn't know anything before then. I really didn't know. I just said, I'm not supposed to read this. I can't read this. You know, I can't talk about this. And then my mother had passed away, and I went to live with my dad. And they had been divorced, so it had been 5 years, I guess, since I had lived with him. And in his bedroom, he had this photograph of this gorgeous man right next to the photograph of Ben Siegel. The gorgeous man was a photograph of Harry Truman, both of them inscribed to my dad, which is such a paradox. But in any event, I asked my dad who this gentleman was. And he told me, you know, it was his best friend, and I'm going to hear a lot of hearsay about him and a lot of things, and just remember he was my best friend, and don't ever call him Bugsy. He told me that. I said, never call him Bugsy. So that was the first, and then the other time was at my mother's funeral when I met Johnny Roselli for the first time. Well, the first time that I remember. I probably met him when I was a little girl. I just don't remember. But I met him, and I saw the two of them together at the funeral with the sunglasses and whispering, and you know, all the other people, all my mom's friends were whispering. It was very strange, and I sort of knew that this man was different. He was so enigmatic. It was like everybody faded, you know, in the room. Everybody became fuzzy, and it was just, you know, Uncle Johnny. So that's when I started to put things together. People told me stories. People told me that I didn't believe it because my dad was, to me, he was in the oil business. You know, he had tried to go into the oil business after Ben's death. That's another whole story. And all of this stuff about, you know, mobsters and gangsters, there's no way, no freaking way. You guys are dreaming. My dad has friends with everybody. I mean, he invites the milkman over to have ice cream. I mean, he was that kind of guy. He just loved people. And loved characters, especially characters. So I really was in complete denial up until, you know, I broke my silence. You know, I finally decided when I was about 40 that I had to find out who my dad and mom were. I just had to know, you know. So that's when it really it was that long. I was that thick-headed, as my father used to say. You know, I was very, very naive and very much afraid of my father, intimidated. He was very intimidating. I mean, one look from him and you would just act like a dog and start barking whatever he needed you to do. He was just so intimidating. So, and he went out in these gorgeous suits and he had business deals and it was always a deal and a deal and a deal and a deal and whatever. You know, and I met his friends, and to me it was all, you know, deals. I had no idea. He covered that very well.
You lived a sheltered life. There was sheltered life then.
Sheltered?
You know, so,
that doesn't
you know,
even
didn't
begin
want
to. No.
Yeah.
Didn't want.
Well,
I know.
He didn't want none of that to touch your life in any way, shape, or form, which happens in, you know, in all, most traditional organized crime members' families. You know, it happens a lot that the families are sheltered. You know, the children are always, you know, pretty much the last to know. They'll hear it from other people in the street before they hear from their own families. You know,
exactly.
They'll hear it in school or they'll hear it somewhere else or somebody will say they've seen, you know, your dad in the newspaper or something like that. And that's how it's usually found out. And then as you get older, you realize that not everybody is living the way that I'm living, you know?
Yeah.
Then you start to see the differences, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's not an easy job because, I mean, even I wasn't allowed to read the newspaper. He would throw it down the incinerator. I said, but my girlfriend, she reads the newspaper. I should be reading the newspaper. This is in high school. He said, I'll tell you what you need to read. If there's a good article, I'll cut it out for you.
If there was a... It's funny you brought that up because if there was like something bad in the newspapers years ago, sometimes as young kids we would get sent to the newsstands, all the newsstands around the neighborhood, and the newspapers used to get dropped off like 1-2 o'clock in the morning for the following day.
Yeah.
You know, and we used to steal all the newspapers. because we were told, get every newspaper in the neighborhood, go and get it. And we would take all, you couldn't get a newspaper if you wanted to in my neighborhood if there was something bad in the newspaper back then.
Exactly.
Because we would all, it was an all-night affair. We would wait for the truck to drop them off at every newsstand and just swoop them up.
Yep. I can just see it. There's whatever, you know, whatever leaks could come through, my father had to plug them. And if somebody opened their mouth at a dinner party, like if Johnny started to say some, okay, girls are here, all right, enough, you know. It's incredible that they actually thought that they could protect us from all this, you know, information that was flowing in, you know, from people gossiping and neighbors and whatever, you know. It was just, he did that every day of his life. You know, he listened on all my phone conversations. No boys would ask me out because the kids at school knew. And he followed me. He had hired guys to follow me when I went trick-or-treating, all that kind of stuff. You know, because we couldn't trust anybody. He had to meet every single friend. I said, Dad, nobody does this. I don't care. I tell you what to do. Don't worry about anybody else. You know, I mean, like, and none of my girlfriends would come spend the night at my house, you know. It really was, I mean, I laugh about it now, but Andrew, you know, it's a very strange on your side. And also, I don't know if you had, you probably didn't have kids then, right? Because you were very young.
Well, no, I had my son. I had a son, and I was away the first five and a half years of his life. I was in prison. So, you know, when I came home, my son didn't know anything of what I was doing or anything like that until I happened to have, I had to go on the run within 17 months of being home. I was already on the run 17 months later. So, you know, when I went away the second time, then he was more understanding about what was happening, you know, to me, and, you know, seeing that I was away again. And then he started to, you know, learn a lot earlier than, you know, what I would like it to have been, you know. But it does happen, you know, and that was the way it happened for him. You know, it was forced upon him due to my incarcerations.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. You know, but I have had friends of mine who, you know, they had daughters and sons or whatever, and, you know, those kids walk in the clouds. You know, they have no idea, you know. They have no idea, you know. I mean, they don't have no idea. It's weird because sometimes I would laugh and go, they have no idea. They don't even know who their dad is. You know, they know their dad, but they don't know who their dad is.
What he does when he leaves the house. I know.
Yeah, exactly.
No office. Yeah, no office. You know, they meet in restaurants and parking lots or whatever. It's like, they do.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They probably kept the restaurant business alive for all those years.
Without a doubt. I mean, I think I went years at a time. I had breakfast, lunch, and dinner out in the street for years at a time. Only on Sunday I would eat at home.
Exactly. I know. Everything is in that arena, and it, you know, it never really, like you said, you know, we just were so protected and so insulated that when we do finally discover it's, and there's so many thousands of kids that are still very ashamed and won't reveal, you know, who their parents are that are out there. I do get emails because now I'm on the web and, you know, everybody finds me, but you know, how did you discover and what do you feel and all of this? And it's sad to me because, you know, every parent has a reason for what they've done in life and every parent has a skeleton. You know,
ours are a little bit more
public.
You're in a situation where, you know, your dad can control the things that he was involved in and his immediate stuff, but the vulnerability in everybody who's in sort of you know, organized crime circles, the vulnerability is always your loved ones, because that's the collateral damage, God forbid. You know what I mean? So it's there.
Yeah.
That's where your defenses aren't their strongest, because, you know, these are where the defenses are weak, because that's why, you know, they try to insulate and keep the family from interacting with other people who they might get these ideas from or learn these other things from. You know, they don't want anybody around them is going to corrupt their minds in any sort of way or try to find a way in. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, safety measures. It's a shame to talk about, but it's safety measures, I guess, that we use for overall survival. You know, it was for survival.
Yeah. My dad wouldn't, like, we lived in a high-rise in Hollywood, and we had a reception where you had to check in. Now, if I forgot my key and came up and didn't get announced and knocked at the door, and my dad came to the door and looked at the peephole, and I said, "Hi, Daddy, it's me. Go back downstairs." "But, Daddy, it's me. Do what I say. Go get announced." Because he thought there was somebody behind me, you know, an FBI guy or, you know, an enemy or something. I mean, he acted so, you know, all of these measures, you know, locking the doors and the drapes and the doors and the drapes and who's that at the door and don't open the, you know, it was like, but I still, it never hit me that there was something, you know, that we were hiding. I just thought my dad was very strange and paranoid.
It's very consuming too, because, you know, when you take such, you know, safety precautions, you know, it's like it's never ending. It never ends.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's like you constantly have to be on your mark. You constantly have to be on point. I used to go home and I'd had a ritual. I would go home, I would drive around a block a few times, I would go up a one way street, I would come back around, I would have when I was real young, I'd have my brother have the door open for me so I could pull into the driveway without even shutting the car off and just getting to the house. I didn't want to be laying in the driveway at night fumbling for my keys to get into my home. So my brother would already have the door open, waiting for me to come, and then that would be it. I would just run in from there, gun in hand, because that's just the way it had to be, you know.
Did you ever get hurt?
No, thank God. You know, I mean, I'm here today, you know, and whatever. But, you know, but I've been involved in a lot of, you know, bad stuff when it came to violence, and I know what the worst case scenarios are, of course. And, you know, the whole idea was, there was an old saying, I don't want to say, you know, you're a woman, I don't want to say talk out of turn on the phone, but there was an old saying, you know, you'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6, so always be prepared. You know what I mean? And those were words to live by, you know? And that's the way we were brought up to carry ourselves, you know? And it's really, like I said, it really takes its toll.
Head.
Yeah, it takes its toll,
know.
Sure. You know,
well,
I still go through the safety precautions. Go ahead, Dennis.
Llewellyn, I move on a little bit about now. Your dad, how old was your dad when he died?
He was 82.
82. And at what point did you decide to research his history, his background?
I have to correct myself. He died in 82. He was 75.
75.
At what point did I start my research?
Yeah.
1993.
Okay, so about
10. Seven.
About 10 years 15. After he passed.
Exactly, 10 years after he passed.
And
it sparked me. Go ahead, ask your question.
I was just wondering, from the research perspective, how difficult was it? I know that you needed to get documents from the government and so forth. What was the cooperation like, and how much of a difficult process was it, if at all, to get the information you were looking for?
It was unbelievable. It's another whole story that we don't have time for. But the in those days, the Freedom of Information Act. Oh, by the way, did you know Ed Becker? Ed Becker?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. He was my first resource. I found him because of the Johnny Roselli story. And this man was incredible to me. He was the only one that would talk to me. I called a number of, you know, different people that were in the documentaries and law enforcement and authors and things like that. He was the only one, and he said, get your dad's files if you really want to know. And he told me great things about my dad, too. So I filed a request. That took 3 years. The real battle was with the Immigration Service. And I knew there was a whole story there because I had gone through the criminal files and seen that he had been, you know, convicted for falsely claiming citizenship because he never got his citizenship when he came here as a kid. He was afraid they would send him back home. And they wouldn't give me the files. I mean, I went to L.A. and they shut the door in my face and they gave me the runaround and the runaround. And at this point, I was so determined. I was like a bulldog. Because I was starting to find out stuff, and it was really important for me to know because I had to find out why I behaved the way I did. And not that I'm a criminal, but just the characteristics, you know, the similarities between us. And, you know, I quit my career, and I quit everything, and just went into this cubicle of research. And the INS would not give me these files. I went, oh, gosh. Anyway, I finally befriended a woman at the headquarters in the archives department, and I told her my story and what I was trying to find out, and she was able to access the file and put through some sort of, you know, documentation that these need to be released to this woman, she's the relative, et cetera, et cetera. And when I got those files, I found out why they wouldn't release them. You want to know why?
Yes.
After Ben was murdered, of course they went to my dad. What do you know? Dad wouldn't say a word. They placed a order of deportation back to Russia on him and got all these trumped up charges because he lied. He said he was born in New York. Big frickin' deal. Said he was born in Chicago, changed the name of his parents. They couldn't figure out where this guy came from. They finally found out, and then they put these three charges over his head with a couple of years in prison. And his greatest line was, I'm not an immunity kind of guy. Okay?
That is a good line. I'm
no.
an immunity kind of guy.
Is that a great line?
Yeah,
I'm
that
not
is a
an
good
immunity
line.
Kind of guy. He said, I'll become a beachcomber in Singapore if my case doesn't stand on its merit. The mob stood behind him. They got together everybody. They paid lobbyists. They paid judges. They paid juries. Don't convict Smiley. Okay, but they did, went to prison. Meanwhile, just before he went in, he had met this wildcatter down in Texas that took a liking to him, that was a big gambler, and said, I'm going to put you in the oil business. You got to get out of this thing. You know, you got to, you're a great guy. I love you. You know, come down to Houston. You work with me. So, now this is really, Andrew, you're not going to believe this. I know this, but this is, according to all these, you know, because he was under wire. He was under surveillance, you know, for like
yeah.
his whole life. I read their conversations, you know. He went to Meyer and asked to get out. He wanted out. And Meyer said, okay, we'll give you the money back from the Flamingo that you invested. And you go off and drill oil wells in Houston. So that was the plan. When he got out of prison, he served 2 years. When he got out of prison, my mother was pregnant. They had everything set up to go to Houston. and this was in the files, Hoover said, no way. You send him back to L.A., to the racket. He'll go broke, and we'll get him then. And that's
wow.
what happened. Yeah. That's why I can't be in the mob museum, because my father would come back and strangle me. I mean, the FBI, really, I believe that he really would have reformed. Yeah, he would have still gambled, and he would have gotten, you know, the boys to invest and whatever, but he had everything figured out, and they eventually the oil business went astray because he couldn't operate in Bel Air oil wells in Texas, and he had 12, 15 leases going, and he had income from it. Even when he died, there was some income coming into me, but they wouldn't let him live there because they wanted to watch him every minute.
That's amazing.
I know.
Llewellyn, when you were trying to get the records, the files, access to the files, information, especially from immigration, did they, like, turn you down flat, or were they just non-responsive? Or,
They kept saying they're classified. I said, okay, so redact the stuff that you don't want me to read. If it wasn't for this woman in D.C., I don't think I would have gotten them because they didn't want me to read all this stuff. And they weren't redacted.
Right.
There was, I think, about 10,000 pages. And the FBI and the INS were working together to bring him down because he would not talk. So they set up, I mean, they almost sent him, I swear to God, they almost sent him to Russia the night that he was released from McNeil Island. They had a plane. They were going to take him over to Russia. And his attorney, the famous guy, I can't think of his name, from New Orleans, I forget. He had like 15 attorneys, and they stopped this order, you know, and so he didn't have to get deported. But he didn't get his citizenship until 1966. So
I remember, I can't remember the name. Bobby Kennedy was involved, and they took him. They basically kidnapped him and took him to a jungle in Guatemala or someplace and dropped him off.
No. See, that was a tactic they used years ago when, like, a few guys got deported. Carlos Marcello got deported.
Gene Connor
have it from? Yeah, Luciano
mm-hmm.
got deported. So that was commonplace for them to, you know, to put the screws to you, you know, to get you to, you know, see your situation or, you know, cooperate with them or whatever it may be. And, you know, legally they were in their rights to do so if, you know, of course, if you're not a citizen and stuff like that. So, you know, would they do it any other given day? No, but because they are in, you know, search of certain information, they will use it, you know, accordingly. And that happened a lot.
Because so many of these guys didn't get citizenship, and that's exactly how they went after a lot of them. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. You know, and then that's a deterrent for them because they're figuring, you know, and let's face it, they know that all his ties would have been here in the States with his family, businesses, and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I had a friend of mine who got deported who was, you know, born in Argentina. They deported him. He wound up having to go back to Canada and then come back to the United States. He came through illegally, but he got back to the United States finally. And then when he got, then they caught him, of course, when he got to the United States. But, you know, when your family is here, you're going to do whatever it takes to get back to your family one way or another.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So he was able to stay here. It was just to have that hanging over his head all the time and to be on parole where he had to check in with the officer and if he was seen with anybody. I mean, he got so defiant that, you know, I see him just walk up to an FBI guy and just toss his hat off his head, take a walk, walk, you know? You don't scare me anymore.
Yeah, well, that's just it. The whole idea is that when it's something that you got to deal with night and day, night and day, night and day, you know, there's two ways to go about it. Just to, you know, face it head on seems to be what your father did. That was the way he dealt with it. Just dealt with it head on, you know. And and a lot of things have changed, of course, you know, through the years, you know, of back then to now. But there's still some lingering, you know, things that the FBI still imposes on people that they have interest in, you know, who may be in the know of information that they know could, you know, maybe solve a case or help on a case or something like that, you know. But a lot has changed over the years.
Yeah, there's. I mean, now it's, you know, international. It's much bigger than it ever was. It's huge now.
Well, now, you know, you just have, you know, everything, you know, grew by leaps and bounds because of, you know, all the technology, you know.
Yeah.
Everything's changed, you know. Now, you know, you could have conversations on the internet with guys from other countries in seconds. You know, exchange information and stuff like that. And so that happens every day.
Yeah.
Llewellyn, after doing all this research, you obviously learned a lot of things. Is there anything in particular that you'd like the public to know about your father?
Yes. The most important thing is that what has been alleged and stated by numerous reporters and documentarians is that, and this was another thing that sparked me into going into research. I watched this documentary about Ben Siegel, and this reporter came on, and she said, Alan Smiley conveniently disappeared into the kitchen when the shots were fired. He was the setup man. Not the case. Not the case. I read every line of the police department report and FBI and all of that. He never moved from that sofa. He had no idea that was coming. The only reason he survived, he ducked under the coffee table when he turned and saw Ben's face, and they found him trembling in the fireplace when they got there.
Dad.
What?
So in the documentary, they were trying to make out to that your dad was complicit in the murder by setting a Siegel up.
Yes. Yes. And then other people pick up on it. Every time I pick up a book, it's the same thing. Smiley was a setup man. My dad was, you know, raised in a very middle-class, Orthodox family. Father was a rabbi. And honor and loyalty, oh, my God, that's it. You know, you don't never.
That's
what I want the public to know. I'm sorry.
It's amazing, too, like you say, that if you take a story and tell it enough times, eventually it becomes fact.
Yeah, O.J. is innocent.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, the fascination with that, with the mob, Andrew, I don't know how you feel about it, but the disillusionment today with our leaders, who the people are supposed to be running the country, it's the smartest people in the world, you know, you look back at these guys that started organized crime and what they built and how they stood up for themselves. Yes, there was bad things. They killed each other, and sometimes an innocent person got in the way, but they made their own rules. And people today, you know, you're afraid to make a racial joke, you're going to go to jail. You know, people are, like, petrified.
Everything's got to be politically correct. You know, everything's got to be set a certain way. You know, the thing of it all is that you realize that some guys who, you know, in organized crime circles, you know, of course, you know, it's a criminal element, but a lot of these guys, had they would put the resources to do other things, could have ran some of the biggest companies in the world, without a doubt.
Without a doubt.
without a doubt. They were intelligent enough to do that for sure. You know, and then, of course, you know, then, of course, you got guys who, you know, ain't got, you know, two thoughts in their head. You know, they just, you know, were violent throughout their lives, and that's the way they got, you know, found success. But for the most part, think about all the things that these guys did. They, you know, very, very easily could have ran a Fortune 500 company, very easily.
Yeah, the entertainment, the resorts, the nightclubs,
I mean,
the people that they made, you know, I mean, really, I mean, Ben came up with the idea of a, you know, golf resort like Palm Springs in Las Vegas. I mean, they really were visionaries, and it's tragic that they weren't given the opportunity to go into a straight line of business, if there is anything anymore, which I don't think there is.
Llewellyn?
Yes. Wow.
I was just going to say, I wanted to, before I run out of time, I wanted to ask you what you think, if you watch any of these programs, the current crop of mob-related TV shows. I know there's been Secrets of the, you know, Mob Wives and Mob Daughters and Mob This and Mob That. Now they got a fairly new series called Vegas. It's based on the career of former Vegas Sheriff Ralph Lamb. Do you watch any of these? And if so, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I want to hear Andrew's too, if we have time. I really, yeah. Mob Wives, okay, that's Campbell's Soup. I mean, that's like, really, you have to be in a bad day to watch that. The Boardwalk Empire, you know, this is the masters of mob cinema that put this together. You know, Scorsese. I am so amazed that all the mob guys do is sit around and drink tea and brandy out of silver goblets in mansions. There's no action. The only action that they have is when somebody gets whacked. I mean, every time I watch it, I'm like, huh? They're at the racetrack. They're on the street. They're making deals. They're doing pranks on each other. You know, these are the boundaries were unlimited with these guys, especially in those days. And you don't see that. They stand around stiff as boards, have these conversations. They're always having does brandy in these mansions, and I find it so absurd that they don't show that other side of the character. Show how outrageous these were big men that lived big every second, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The gambling is so fascinating that they would bet on whether a fly would go out the window, you know.
I don't even think I bet on a fly, but I know I bet on some other real silly stuff.
Yeah, but you know, Andrew, I mean, your life, did you sit around in a brick mansion in New York and discuss, you know, who's going to get whacked?
No, not unless I was taking some out of it. I mean, that would have been the only time I'd be sitting in a mansion, you know. but basically, you know what the thing is that, you know, when it came to that Boardwalk Empire, I've never really watched it. I really haven't. I've seen bits and pieces of it, you know, reruns that I would, like, go through when I'm channel surfing, but I never really sat down to really watch episode after episode to catch the storyline. I've never done that.
I don't think
and, it didn't raise any interest to me, you know, for any other reason. I mean, of course, yeah. I heard, you know, conflicting stories. Some people really like it. Some people, you know, could do without it. And so I never did it. Maybe now I will. Maybe now I'm going to take a shot and see what what it is. I get my own opinion, but as it stands now, I've never really even followed a storyline, you know?
Yeah. Guys, I'm sorry, we got to wrap it up here. We're out of time. Llewellyn, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. I hope you'll come back again.
Thank you. I hope so, Andrew.
Nice to speak with you,
Llewellyn.
Nice to speak to you.
Really, I agree.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Please join us on November 21st for another installment of We Know a Guy Radio. Don't forget to check out BearMediaConsultants.com, the place to go if you want to get connected. And if you'd like to book Andrew or Llewellyn or any of the Bear Media personalities as a consultant for your project or a speaker for your event, Email me at griff1945@hotmail.com. Thanks to our producer, Kim Colton, for manning the switchboard. Until next time,
thank you,
God bless. Stay safe and good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Well, good night, Andrew. Good night, Kim.
Good night.
Good night.